the Miners Hospital.
If you have cell phones, please either turn them off or turn them to vibrate.
We'll do, and then you get the red stripe.
And there are people listening on the internet, so when you speak, please identify yourself. Floor is yours.
Good afternoon. I am Mary Ellen Young. I'm the executive director for the Wyoming Miners Hospital Board.
I am Don Stauffenberg. I'm chairman of the Miners Hospital Board.
I would first like to ask if there's any questions about our board at all, or would you like me to go right into the exception request, because I know we have some new members here.
Please. Well, I'll tell you what. Why don't you take us through your budget and explain a little bit your concept and so forth, so we and people listening on the internet can hear it, can hear about it, and then we'll get to the exception budget.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Miners Hospital Board was set up in 2001. The funds actually were appropriated during the Constitution, when Wyoming became a state, through 30,000 acres of land. Over time, that, of course, fund has grown, and in 2001, the legislators, of course, there was some legal problems with how the money was being spent. The legislators formed this Wyoming Miners Hospital Board. I was a member from day one of the hospital board, and I'm also a retired miner, as a 32-year uranium and coal miner. Over time, the funds have grown. We've been allowed by statute since the beginning of time to spend up to 5% a year of the total of the income fund and the corpus. We've never had to budget the full 5% up until the 1920 budget. We're over 8,000 miners registered right now, and that's really only a small portion of the number of miners that are eligible for our funds. We have two programs that we spend money on. The first one is the hearing aid program, where we provide up to $2,000 every 5 years for the purchase of hearing aids. We also help with repairs when the warranty runs out, after 2-3 years, whatever their warranty is, they need a repair, but they're not eligible yet for more money for another set of hearing aids. We help with repairs. The other program we have is the Miners Medical Assistance Program. And with that, a miner is eligible for up to $5,000 per year for medical and prescription expenses related to hearing loss other than hearing aids, which a lot of times that's impacted earwax, cardiac problems, respiratory, and muscle skeletal. All of the problems that we deal with need to be due to labor in the mining industry. No slips, falls, accidents, or injuries at home, they're all work-related. We are a payer of last resort. So whether the miner has private insurance, Medicare, Medicaid, whatever they have, they pay first, we pay last, up to $5,000 a year.
Representative Larson.
If it's related to mining, would not workers' compensation come into play?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Larson, workers' comp wants a date, time, and incident where an accident or injury occurred. The majority of claims we pay for are long-term wear and tear on the body. It can be years of running equipment, turning wrenches, walking on concrete, and workers' comp they've never really paid those. If a worker gets injured at work, they twist their back, twist their ankle, fall down, break a leg, and there's an incident, time, and date, that falls under workers' comp. Most of the stuff that we pay for, in fact, if it does fall under workers' comp, then it takes it off our plate. But the majority of them are long-term wear and tear. Especially cardiac has been related to long hours, the 12-hour shifts, and the rotating shifts. Respiratory, that can be anything from dust to diesel fumes, particulates in the air, that sort of thing.
Does the you don't have to actually prove causation if from the minor, you know, to get funding from the Miners Hospital, do you?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct to a point. If it's coded as something that falls under a long-term wear and tear problem, then we pay it. If coded as an accident, somebody fell off their ladder painting their house and sprained their back, it's coded as an accident, we're not going to pay for it. Because it either should have been reported. If it's an accident at work, then it's a workers' comp issue. If right. it's an accident at home, not job-related, then it's not something we would pay for.
But, for instance, if I worked in coal mine in Gillette for 20 years and I ended up getting a bad knee, I'm assuming you're...
Mr. Chairman, that's yes. correct.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Summers.
Mr. Chairman, did you say one of them was heart attack or heart problems? Because, and what about if you're a smoker?
Cardiac. Mr. Chairman and Representative Summers, we have never, we go ahead and pay it. It could be related to smoking. It could be related to diesel fumes or particulates at work, dust. To get a doctor to narrow it down exactly why they're having heart problems is extremely difficult. So we have chosen to not do that. We've kind of gone the back way and said, if it's obviously not work-related, we're not going to pay for it.
How many miners are currently employed in the state of Wyoming?
Mr. Chairman, employed?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, Don Stauffenberg, I have the number from the state mine inspector's report of 2016, which is the last one. There are 9,650 miners and 3,070 mine site contractors for a total of 12,722 employed, not counting those that have retired or worked that 1 year of service and are eligible for benefits. But
that was my next question. Is there a threshold?
1 year. We would like to change that, Mr. Chairman. It's 1 year right now. We would like to change that to protect the fund itself, expenditures to the fund itself. I personally don't believe that you can be affected by any of the illnesses that we cover in 1 year's employment. And if it was something catastrophic, it probably would have been a workers' comp incident. And if they didn't report that, it would still be recorded at the doctor's office as an accident.
Right.
So that 1 year threshold is problematic.
Okay. So the 12,000 figure that you
yes
mentioned, that's who are eligible.
Those are employed miners. We don't know.
You
we
mentioned there are 2,000. Who are currently employed?
There, Mr. Chairman, there are 12,700 that are currently
employed.
Currently employed.
Okay.
How many of those have the 1 year service, Mr. Chairman? It is unknown.
And then, if you're retired, you're also still eligible.
If you're, Mr. Chairman, if you're retired, you still fall under the. Under the auspices of the program, if you worked a year and decided that you weren't a miner, you're...
And so everybody who's currently employed and retired, so how do you have an estimate of how many people are eligible for this fund?
Mr. Chairman, I think the numbers are huge. Because the requirements are anyone who's worked 12 consecutive months on a mine site and are a Wyoming resident. That could have been 40 years ago that they worked 12 consecutive months.
Do you so, have a figure?
No.
You don't?
No. I think it would be easily to say three to four times that number that are currently employed. And right now we have a little over 8,000 members that are registered for our benefits.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you could remind me from our days when you reported to Labor and Health, if they're a minor in Wyoming, they retire and leave the state, does that disqualify them from benefits? And then, for example, up in coal country, we may have minors working in the state but live in Montana or vice, you know, or maybe they work in Montana and live in Wyoming. How does that play out for eligibility?
Representative Larson, the eligibility is that they have to be a Wyoming resident and can work in a neighboring state. So those, and that particularly applies to like Decker Coal. We do have some miners that American.
I'm sorry, I missed that, and I live up in Sheridan.
So. Okay.
So Decker employees and Spring Creek mine employees are eligible?
Yes, they are. If they're Wyoming residents, even though they work in Montana, they're still eligible.
Do we get any money from either the state of Montana or either those companies or mines?
No, we don't.
Huh. All right.
We also have some miners towards the South Dakota border that the mine is in Wyoming, but there's no place to live close to the mine, so they live in South Dakota. They're not eligible for benefits, so it only works one way. And there was another part to your question. If they move out of state, they lose their benefits. And this spring, I really started, this spring, I had my assistant start tracking the first claim of the year. We look, because we now house all the records. We contract out with EBMS and Billings to pay all of our claims. They used to house all of our personnel or all of our registration records. After I've asked a couple times to look up certain things and they couldn't find them. In 2012, we started housing them ourselves on the state drive. So when a miner has the first claim of the year, we go back and look in our files and say, do we have a current Wyoming driver's license on file for this person? If we do, not a problem, we pay the claim. If we don't, we send them a letter and say, we need a current Wyoming driver's license. And update whatever records, maybe have an address change, insurance change, and update that. We've terminated many, several hundred people that either didn't respond, and we have 23 people that I've tracked that have moved out of state, and we were paying benefits for, which we've been able to recoup almost all of that money. We get with EBMS, and we've been in contact with our attorney general rep, and we're making sure that we're doing everything above board. They're sent a letter saying, we don't think you're eligible for these benefits anymore. If you disagree, please provide that documentation. And if they don't, they're given so much time. And if they don't, then they're sent a letter saying, hey,
Senator,
you've lost benefits.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, a couple of things. Clarification on that. The mine is located over the border. The employees live in Wyoming, they're still not eligible. We got 270 employees live in Wyoming, but they cross over the border every day to work in a big phosphate mine in Idaho.
No, that's, you're talking about
Smoky Canyon.
Yes, they are eligible and they are registered.
They're all good.
The mine can be across the property, but the miner has to be a Wyoming resident.
Which they are. Okay, and quick follow-up, Mr. Chairman. This is trending up or down use of your services?
Trending up.
Are we spending more money? Are we going to
drastically
continue?
More. What has impacted us more than anything is a lot of the companies, because of the Affordable Care Act, have gone to high deductibles with or without an HSA.
Because of the what?
Affordable Care Act.
Okay. He banged some books when you spoke.
A lot of the companies are going to a health savings account. Therefore, they have to have a high deductible. Some of the companies, it's a mandatory that they belong to a health savings account. Some of it's not mandatory, but everybody's getting a higher deductible. The way we pay our claims, we don't know what your deductible is, because all these miners are not our employees. They have all kinds of benefit programs and all kinds of deductibles. So when we get a claim in, and you might have had shoulder surgery, and it's a payable claim, they haven't met their deductible. So the first dollar amount, it'll be sent to, let's say, Blue Cross Blue Shield. They say, okay, the first $2,000 goes towards your deductible. Then they send it to us. We pay that $2,000. So instead of paying $500, $750 per person deductible, we're now paying $2,000, $3,000 and upper thousands of dollars in deductible. That's where we've really seen it take off, and that was about January of this year that it really made a difference.
So you also don't necessarily know if they maybe they have $500 deductible, you're still sending them $2,000?
No, they are only getting what insurance
says. Well, they have
to
show you what their deductible is.
Yes, right. Yes.
Okay. Representative Larson.
I'm just wondering, Mr. Chairman, the comment that you made earlier that the Miners Hospital is a payer of last resort, if they have insurance and the insurance pays, how then do you justify paying the deductible?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Larson, because our statute reads that we pay their out-of-pocket expenses. Their deductible is considered an out-of-pocket expense.
And this is the rest of their lives?
Yes. It does cap at $5,000 a year, but it's a lifetime benefit, yes.
All right. Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman? Just a
Senator
couple
Hastert.
Clarifications. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know there was a couple comments about mines that are, like in your area, each of your areas, that the mine is actually located out of the state. And the thought process was, years ago when this was developed, was that we would support that it would needed to be supportive of the residents. It was for the residents of Wyoming that worked in a mine. And those border mines, because the people lived in the state, were supportive. And I got to say also just on a little historical note on that, the Miners Hospital, as Mary Ellen stated, was developed in the Act of Admission, and the Rock Springs Hospital was considered the Miners Hospital for many years and for decades. And everyone had to travel to Rock Springs if they wanted a service. And it was very limited service, and miners basically got together and had some discussion with the governing bodies at the time, and the decision was made to form the Miners Hospital Board. Now a miner in any part of the state can receive benefits anywhere and doesn't have to go to a specific, property. They don't have to go to Rock Springs. They can receive benefits in Gillette or in Rock Springs or in Kemmer or in Star Valley. And if their injury, or I shouldn't say injury, if their issue is something that's covered under the Miners Hospital, then submit, because I've done it. You submit all the forms, and then, boy, if you don't submit a form, you don't get anything. You submit the proper forms, and then you get paid for eligible services, which is covered under the, because at the time it was decided that these were the musculoskeletal, hearing, cardiac, and respiratory were unmet needs for miners. So.
When you... when we were talking about who's eligible, does that include gravel pit and quarry employees?
Mr. Chairman, yes, it does, if they have work in the mine site. We have a lot of sand and gravel where there's road construction.
Right.
The road construction employees are not. They have to prove their time in the crushers in the pit.
Okay, we've gotten to who's eligible and what you do and how you do it. Now we're getting to the budget. And I like the background you gave us. Thank you very much. Okay, so the first step is, where does your money come from?
It comes from the Permanent Land Trust Fund.
And how is the money put into that?
It's income generated off the Permanent Land Trust, off the lands. And we have two funds, and we're allowed to spend off the total of the two funds, the Permanent Land Trust Fund and the Income Fund, but the money is only drawn out of the Income Fund.
But how does money go into the Permanent Land Trust Fund? Where does that money come from?
Mr. Chairman, we don't
appropriate it.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
If I may. Thank you. I can answer. That's state leases.
Right. Okay. So that's what I was trying to
get
to.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, income from that acreage.
That's exactly where I'm trying to go with this.
Yes. Okay.
Income, Mr. Chairman, income from that acreage.
From the act of admission, state leases, a portion goes into the permanent mineral land trust.
Yes.
Correct.
Okay. All right. So how much money is in the trust right now?
It's a little over $100 million.
And how much is in the income trust?
Oh, that's total of the two.
It's two.
Oh, that's the total of the two?
That's the total of the two.
Mr. Chairman, total of the two.
Okay.
So, Mr. Co-Chair.
Do we have a breakdown? Have they sold any of the properties and then earning interest off of that? Are these all land lease dollars? Or how is that? Have we got a breakdown of that from lands in the past?
Mr. Chairman, I can get a breakdown. I think very little, if any, have been sold. And on pages 13 and 14, it shows the two funds. The first fund is the permanent fund. It's about 70-ish million. And then the second fund is the income fund. And that is derived in two ways. Number one, there are income streams off of the land, such as easements that don't go into the permanent fund. And then in the investment income from page 13 spills over into page 14.
And if it's any sort of mineral leases, which fund does that go into?
Mr. Chairman, it is a combination of the both. There are royalty payments, which would go to the permanent fund, and there are bonus payments if there's an oil lease bonus, and that would go to, I believe, the income fund.
And so, I mean, 30,000 acres, right? Is that what it started with? I'm just curious how much is leased to ag versus some of plus oil leases, what the income has been over time, and if we're getting the highest and best use for that. Has there been analysis on that in your recent past?
Mr. Chairman, the Office of State Lands has done some analysis, not specific to these lands, but all state lands. I believe there are 13 different land funds, one for fish hatcheries, one for the College of Agriculture at UW. This is one of those. And they have done analysis as to are they getting the best bang for the buck. You can see also the history of the income on pages 13 and 14, both into the permanent fund as well as the investment income.
I'm sorry we're taking you through some of these rudimentary steps, but we want to make sure not only that we all have the background information on it, but also this is going out over the Internet so other people who are listening understand what we're dealing with and, you know, who we're dealing with and why we're dealing with it.
Mr. Chairman, if I could back up to the question of the people who work in Decker and Spring Creek and live in Wyoming, that's in the statute.
Yes.
Yes. Everything is backed by, everything we've done is backed by statute.
Yes. No, we don't think you're just decided to do this on your own.
No, but if there was a question of the statute number, I have the statute number.
Okay. So we've gotten to the income. Now let's go through your budget.
Okay. And Mr. Chairman and committee members, I've been in this position since 2011. It took several years from the past executive director to get miners interested in this program, actually to learn about it and to have mines back us up with it, because honestly the registration form, we need employment verification, which comes for their employer that proves that they were an employee or are an employee and meet the criteria. There's a wording on the registration form that led the mines to believe that if they received, the miner received any benefits from us, somehow that was holding them culpable of health problems. So it was a long time in coming to get any of these miners to start signing up, because the employers didn't want to push the program. They didn't want to help. When it finally became clear to them, no, this is a free benefit because they're a state, a Wyoming resident, they're a minor, and there are funds set aside for this, it blossomed. And to begin with, we had these programs, and not to say anything negative about the past executive director, bless his heart, he's passed away, but there was nobody watching the back door. And we were running out of money. And we had a fraction of the minors registered that we have now. So one of the things we did, first off, we changed in 2009, we changed eligibility that it used to be one day on a mine site. Anybody was eligible for benefits for life if they worked one day on a mine site. They could have delivered a sandwich for a banquet, and they would have gotten benefits for life. So we changed that. I mean, we have tweaked things over the years to try to make sure that we were good stewards of that money and that it lasts as long as it possibly can, that those who are eligible, those people that are eligible to receive the money are getting the money, and that we can continue paying it out. Something that goes into effect this next year, we've had to impose our own deductible. It's called a first claim benefit. So the first $2,000 that a miner sends to us for eligible claims, we pay. The next $2,000 that they send to us goes towards their deductible with us. And then if they meet that $2,000 deductible, they're eligible for the other $3,000. So we're still paying out $5,000, but now the miners have a little bit of, they've got to pony up a little money too.
As far as the eligibility goes, it was one day, now it's 1 year, and you want to expand that. Is that something that the board has the authority to do?
Mr. Chairman, no.
Is that statutory?
Has statutory. It's also in the statutes.
Okay, so that's a bill you would like us to bring.
I would mercifully like you to do that, yes.
And what is the period of time you would like us to set in there?
Mr. Chairman, I would like to see 10 years.
10 years? Okay.
You know, and then truly, if a person was employed in a mine for 10 years, you wouldn't have a question of accumulated abuse on joints and muscles and lungs and heart. You could in all conscience say, yeah, he probably got that from mining.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, we've discussed this as a board. Me personally, because I deal with the miners all the time, I wouldn't have any problem with saying after a certain date, 1980, and I have to do some more homework on this really, when they really got involved with more safety factors at work, after a certain date they need 10 years. Before that, because we honestly, I deal with them every day, there's a lot of broken up underground coal miners and uranium miners that have nothing. They have no pension. They have no insurance. They're lucky they have Medicare. Some of them don't have supplemental. Some of them bounced around a lot. Some of them didn't get the full 10 years in before their companies closed down. So this is something the board is going to discuss, but I think in order to continue with the program and paying any sort of a benefit that really makes a difference and helps them, we're going to have to change the eligibility.
And so you'd want it retroactive back to what date?
Mr. Chairman.
You mentioned 1980.
And I'm just throwing that out there.
You don't have a more specific date in mind?
Mr. Chairman, the Mine Health and Safety Act of the Department of Labor, it came into effect in 1979, mid-year. I don't think they got the inspectors out into the field and the like until, you know, like 1980.
Yeah.
Okay. I started mining underground uranium in 1963, and I never saw an inspector until probably the U.S. Bureau of Mines would come around once in a while. I never saw an inspector probably until 68, 69.
Okay, so when you threw out 1980, that wasn't an arbitrary date you were throwing out?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Hassler.
Mr. Chairman, I hate to do this like this, but and I'm going to get some more information. It's not in statute. It is the ability of the board to do that. And I think this was tried, and the problem is I'm not fully remembering. I've asked to get a clarification, but I think this was tried, and there was a reason that we were told, or that I was told that we couldn't put the year limitations on it. And I don't remember the whole story, but it's not in statute. It's something that would be a board rule. But I need to understand and recall why we, when it was looked into, why it wasn't done at a different time. But it's not in statute.
So theoretically, according to you, it's something they could promulgate.
Yes, but it would have to be submitted through the channels. But I think it was denied when it was.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hastert, exactly. We tried to do 5 years, and we were told that we did not have the authority to change that.
Because we tried to do it as a rule. At the time, we had just set an arbitrary date of 1 year, and it slipped through.
All right, well, so, that's something that's LSO is going to research for us. We'll find out at what level it needs to be done, but you feel it needs to be done to preserve the corpus.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hastert.
Now, just recall that the statute says they're only entitled to, on a biennium, 5% of the corpus, that the balance of the corpus. So at no time can anybody dig in deeper than the 5%. So it's never going to – and the problem that they'll be discussing here was that last biennium – they were only given, I think, 3% of the corpus, somewhere in that vicinity. I don't have the exact number. But anyway, so that is what created the problem. And they're going to explain.
But now they're at the 5%.
Why they want to go to the 5%, why that's an issue. But you can never, by statute, you can never get more than 5% of the combined corpus.
Okay. Representative Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just reading through the statutes, it would appear to me that the board has the ability to determine eligibility, is I think that the language that they use. And so I am struggling to see why setting the time frame, you know, and LSO can give us more direction on that too. But I was also trying to, I'm still going back to the paying for the deductible thing, and it's certainly not in statute. So are you telling me that that's just in your rules, that you pay for out-of-pocket expenses?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Larson, and maybe I do stand corrected, maybe that's in the rules. But the wording is, and I didn't bring a copy of the rules and statutes with me, it does say that we pay their out-of-pocket expenses. Now, I know that we've talked to EBMS, and the board has discussed not paying a person's deductible. The problem comes in, we don't know what your deductible is.
And Mr. Chairman, and then also the comment as pair of last resort must be a board role. And then it talks about, and Don, it'd be interesting if we could find a copy of that. Healthcare needs an assessment of Wyoming minors that we could just look at, because I think most of your decisions are supposed to be based on that report. And then I would almost, maybe we ought to look at this a little clearly. I think you could read this statute. It's short, but I think that perhaps we should maybe be a little more involved in the minors hospital perhaps than what we are in reviewing some of this stuff, Mr. Chairman.
Well, as far as eligibility goes, we'll get an answer to that soon enough. So let's go through your standard budget right now. And seeing that, I don't see anything particularly out of line between the standard and the base budget.
And, Mr. Chairman, honestly, which page do you want me to start on?
Well, let's go to the exceptions.
Okay.
And I think your first one is on page 15.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that's their only, the only exception request, isn't it? Yes. And we have, as was stated earlier, we have never maxed out and used the full 5% of the monies that we are eligible to use. And with this exception request, we use all but $581,000. And I felt that was necessary because we're seeing such a high volume of expenses and number of minors registered are growing. As soon as somebody gets 1 year of service, they're signing up for our benefits. And we really don't have that many people dropping off the back end. There's not that many people passing away or moving, so we're just accumulating people all the time. So I did try to budget in really almost as much as possible because I can't project an exact number for expenses. And this is all in the 900 series, so it's all benefits paid out. It's our contract and benefits paid out. The rest is all very manageable. But this, because of the nature of our business, medical expenses, and then minors being registered. And every day I'm amazed at minors that mined 20, 30, 40 years ago that are just finding about our program. And, of course, most of them are eligible for our benefits.
So when you have your spending authority and if you have not spent as much at the end of the year as you were budgeted to spend, that goes back into the income account?
Mr. Chairman, yes. It actually never really comes out.
Oh, okay. So it's just the carry balance.
Absolutely, yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Burkhardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the amount requested on the priority one exception request, how did you arrive at that number?
Honestly, Mr. Chairman and Representative Burkhardt, I went and budgeted, made sure all my numbers were correct in all the other divisions, and then I said, okay, how much money do I have left before I max out that 5%, and that's what I put in the 900 series.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, so really it's a guess.
Correct. But Senator Burkhardt, it's this year, looking at the numbers and the projections, we are going to run short.
So, Mr. Chairman, so what have your expenditures been, say, each year for the past 5 years?
Chairman and Senator Burkhardt, the 14 and 15 budget, I know that we had, of the whole budget, there was $750,000 we didn't spend. The 15-16 budget, excuse me, the 15-16 budget, okay, 15-16, we were $2 million to the good that we budgeted that we didn't spend. Things were looking great. And then the high deductibles started hitting us. So it's been, the 13-14 budget is when I came on, and we had to go back to the governor twice for a B-11. One for $1 million, one for $1.2. So it's run like this. But the last 2 years, just basically this budget, this biennium budget, is seeing ever-increasing enrollment and expenses.
Mr. Chairman, so could you get that information for us, please, for the past 5 years?
The yes,
number I will. Of clients or number of people who were paid and the amounts paid out? Thank you.
Yes.
So if you've got, you're restricted to 5% of the corpus, and let's say that's $5 million, and the bills come in
and you're most of the way through the year and, or the biennium rather, and you've hit that 5 million three quarters of the way through, then what happens? You just can't pay out anymore?
Mr. Chairman, it's in our, I believe it's in the statute that the program shut down.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, there was a time when we suspended the hearing aid program to cover medical costs for the remainder of a biennium. I think that was two bienniums ago.
Yes, and that was for about 3 months.
Okay. Any other questions, so, Mr. Co-Chair?
I have a question. So if we can assist you by changing, I mean, statutorily we can do it. We can change the time levels of when you start become qualified. Would you suggest we do that before we give you an extra $1.8 million so you can send the money more where it needs to go versus where your claims?
Mr. Chairman, if that bill took effect immediately upon passage,
Mr. Chairman and Representative Nichols, that might throw us a huge lifeline. The only cushion or where I didn't have a problem with budgeting as much as possible is knowing that the money never really comes out of the account, so it continues to draw interest. And if we don't use it, it stays within our fund. So I felt okay allocating that much money. But if we could meet our needs another way, I'm all for that.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
Representative Summers.
Mr. Chairman, the spending authority on this account by statute is 5%. There would be no reason the legislature couldn't take a look at that to lower that, as in fact we lowered our spending authority on some other accounts as well. So we could in fact put that more in line with what other spending authorities are as well.
Did we ever get an answer on eligibility?
Mr. Chairman, Tamara Revely, staff attorney to the Joint Appropriations Committee with LSO. I did pull up the rule review from 2012, which LSO recommended that council recommend to the governor that the agency rescind its rules, and the agency did rescind the rules. That rule review is in LSO SharePoint on the calendar and then the LSO drive. It's ARR 12-059. LSO drew the conclusion that the State Minors Hospital Act 36-101 at SEC contains an exhaustive, explicit definition of what constitutes a minor who may receive services for eligible injuries. Because it's exhaustive, the board could not go beyond what was in statute.
What was the statute?
36-101.
So in other words, the eligibility, if it's moved up from 1 year to, let's say, 5 years or 10 years, is going to have to be done in statute?
Mr. Chairman, that's the position LSO took in this rule review. The statutes provide that the board may determine what services or benefits are provided, but not a new eligibility criteria.
Okay, so it's 36-101?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
All right, and so if we want to increase the eligibility, we're going to have to bring a bill?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that's correct.
So I would move that we bring a bill. The bill draft to change it to 5 years.
Second.
5 years?
To start with, right? Yeah.
The board's suggesting 10.
Mr. Chairman, we can live with five. We'd love to see 10, but we can say honestly, again, looking at the wear and tear on bodies, you know, that could be legitimate in 5 years.
Okay, so the mover has changed to 10. The second is agreed as a friendly amendment, so it's 10 years. And it's been moved and seconded. Any discussion? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a question. If we change it to 10, does that rescind the eligibility of already approved minors or not?
You'd have to start over again.
Mr. Chairman, just one other point of discussion. As long as in the bill, can we have the discussion at that time about whether that 5 should be lowered to 4?
It'll just be a draft.
Yeah.
It's not 5, it's 10.
The 5% spending.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any other comment? Seeing none. This is to have a bill drafted. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Voila.
Mr. Chairman, thank you.
That's the beauty. You don't like a law, you make a new one.
That has me breathing better. Where would you like me to go next?
I think unless there's anything else you want to add, I think everybody's happy.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hastert's not happy.
Oh, I'm very happy, Mr. Chairman. Always. Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to just note, and while the folks are here, is they saw the shortage coming, and instead of just and being entitled to the 5% spending authority, and having that number had been reduced for the biennium, and incurring the new issues of the higher deductibles and the more minors. I can say that I applaud them in the fact that they looked for ways of, reducing the spending on the board themselves. Is that saying, hey, let's in the spirit of the act, and I think that's, and I do believe that the increase in the years of eligibility is more in the spirit of the act, because it does say that the act of admission injuries due to work in the mines, but the board, is doing actions to help themselves, and by reducing the benefits putting more on the miners too. So, it's kind of a dual thing there.
Representative Summers.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Just one other note. I do want to read that in the statute. Serve disabled or incapacitated minors in this state with emphasis on pulmonary, respiratory, hearing loss, cardiac, and musculoskeletal conditions of minors due to labor in the mining industry. And so I think this 10-year is going to help that. But it's also, I think, incumbent upon your board to examine what codes you decide to code, So I think you have some flexibility, it seems to me, to make sure that that is due to labor in the mining industry. And so if you got somebody that's, way overweight and smoking, and he's got a pulmonary or cardiac problem, you might want to examine that code.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Summers, you're exactly right. And something I didn't mention on before, that we have really closely with EBMS on the codes that we pay for. Not to say there isn't room for improvement, but when I first took on, they were instructed to pay for anything that fell under muscle skeletal. I know personally a person I used to carpool with that got drunk and fell off his deck and broke his leg, and we paid for it. So we have really, really reined in what we're paying for. And like I say, not saying that there isn't room for improvement, and thank you for that, bringing that up.
Anything else? Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Mr.
Appreciate it. And have a safe drive home.
Thank you.
All right. Next step is the Board of Equalization. Oh, yeah, I remember you. Welcome. Turn on your mics, please. The button that has looks like a guy sneezing. There you go. You're both on. And you're on the Internet, too, so... speak clearly, and when you do speak, say who you are so people listening on the Internet can hear.
Thank you. I will do so. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Marty Hartzog. I'm chairman of the Board of Equalization. With me on my right is Dave Delacat. He is a board member with the Board of Equalization.
Good afternoon.
And also with us is our executive assistant, Ms. Nadia Broom, right behind. And she's instrumental in putting all this together.
I'm sorry, the name Nadia?
Nadia.
I've never heard it with a long A before.
It took me a little while to get used to it as well. Mr. Delacat is just newly appointed only about 4 months ago and replaced Dave Groover, who was with us a short time. We've had some turnover with the board.
He's been with everybody a short time.
Miss Jane Monkler is our vice chairman, and she and I drew straws to see who could got the opportunity to present today, and I won.
Oh.
She is with the governor at the cabinet meeting, so... she apologizes for not being here with us.
Tell Esther we miss her.
I certainly will. As a jumping off point, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, or committee, the Board of Equalization is often cited as the example of that agency that's so small that really there's just not a whole lot of maneuvering room when it comes to the budget. And I think that's going to be demonstrated today. The board consists of three people, and I've identified those, and three staff members. We have a staff attorney slash executive secretary. We have a board statistician, which works with us very closely on our equalization and uniformity duties. And we have our executive assistant who is with us. The board used to have seven people or four staff members, and we gave up that position years ago and combined duties. And so... we are now a six-person agency. The board has no vacancies and expects no vacancies at this point. I think that was one of the questions that had come up. I'm certainly happy to tell you all about what the board is. We are Wyoming's tax court, and we are a constitutional body, but the constitutional side of our duties really addresses the uniformity and taxation side of it. We've existed since before the state existed, so we were here at the time Wyoming was a territory, and it's changed over the decades quite a bit. Primarily what we do is we hear tax appeals. Any kind of state-assessed tax or state-based tax, whether that be at the local level or at the state-assessed level, we are the court of first impression, except for local property tax appeals. Those go to the original county board as the local board of county commissioners, local county board of equalization. And then if they don't like that ruling, either the assessor or the taxpayer, they can appeal that ruling to the board of equalization. But all state-assessed taxes, that's mineral sales and state-assessed property, things like pipelines and railroads, all of those are heard before the board of equalization in the first instance. And we are, the three of us are governor appointed and confirmed by the Senate.
I'm just curious. Do the majority of your, cases that you hear are mineral related?
Mr. Chairman, we have a break out of that. I would not say that. Now, there was a time, and I used to practice in front of the board with the Attorney General's office. I headed the tax division and then was deputy of civil, but, at a time, especially when coal bed methane was in full swing, and when we had all of the fights with the large producer processors, the Amocos, the Exxons, the Chevrons, I would say that was the case. Yes, it was more mineral than anything. And if you have to throw out some of the take in kind is kind of an interesting concept, but most of those, if not all of them, dismissed because it's really a problem between the operator and the take in kind interest holder. But in terms of what actually goes to a full hearing, I would say it's about half and half, sales tax versus a mineral tax. And, of course, everything from the local level is property tax. And,
right.
And that can be some of the larger industrial applications, or it can just be a home, ranch land, whatever the case may be.
If somebody's going to appeal, let's say a homeowner, they're just mad. and they appeal to you, is there any kind of fee they have to pay to appeal all the way up to you?
Mr. Chairman, we don't impose any fee whatsoever.
Okay, just curious.
Ever. The thing, you obviously would behoove you to have an attorney. And then if there's a record, if you want a copy of the transcript, oftentimes we have to just record our proceedings, and we have only a recording.
I was curious because I've got a constituent who's very litigious, and I think you've seen him a few times. And I was just curious if he had ended up having to pay anymore.
No, we impose no fee, and we did expand our jurisdiction just last year. In fact, before the legislature, we now also preside over fuel tax appeals, which had been coming out of the Department of Transportation. But because it's a Title 39 tax and because it's a tax much like an excise tax, we were able to convince the legislature to move that over to the Board of Equalization. We also hear appeals from liquor license revocation proceedings, but those are so far and few between. I was involved in one in 98, and we've never had one since. But should there be one, and they want to appeal at the administrative level, they would come to us.
Okay.
So that's basically our jurisdiction. But I should go back and also point out much of our jurisdiction is just dealing with assessors and through a statistical mass appraised analysis, looking at all of the valuations throughout the state to ensure a uniformity based on various appraisal principles. And that requires that we have hearings with all 23 assessors after getting mass amounts of information and doing lots of analyses on their valuations. And if that should turn into a problem, and every now and then it does, that's where the word equalization comes into play. We would at that point, after exhausting basically every opportunity to get it fixed, that would require that we go to that county and have hearings and almost take over the process to correct whatever imbalance is occurring.
Now, so, when a help me out because I'm ignorant here. When a county assessor, when they're doing their assessing on property, and they're generally using a formula, a common formula, so that there's uniformity throughout, and I think it's CAMA, if I'm not mistaken, is the acronym. Does that come from you,
Mr. Chairman? No, CAMA is established through the Department of Revenue.
Okay, so it's the Department of Revenue that gives them the template.
Yes, and Department of Revenue is the mentor, the regulator, the instructor of all county assessors.
Okay.
And we are oversee the process in a sense. And in that regard, we're not an adjudicative body. I would call us more of a regulatory body.
Okay.
We would step in not as the court but as kind of the overseer to force whatever change needs to be made.
Okay.
But we review all of the valuations on a gross basis, mass appraisal basis, and look at it, and it comes down to just numbers on a page, because obviously we're looking at whole classifications of property compared across the board. And if we're seeing too much deviation from kind of the ideal comparative sale average, that's where we have to take note and decide what's going on, and then we can actually look at individual sales and their practices to decide if what they're doing is causing some kind of statistical aberration that we can fix or that needs to be fixed.
Okay. So, sounds good.
So,
I'm sorry, Senator Driscoll.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. A couple questions. On your numbers of cases, as you see them come through, sales tax or other, do you see patterns sometimes that maybe we ought to do statute fix to tighten the law up? Because we never hear from you on it. We hear from revenue a little. But obviously, you probably get repeat cases that are holes. Do you have a bullet list for us of stuff you could provide us of things you think need fixed on it?
Mr. Chairman.
If they do.
Senator Driscoll, I'll tell you. That's something that we don't do because we are a quasi-judicial body, and so we do not lobby or we will certainly answer questions, but we do not proactively go to the legislature and say, here's a problem you have with these statutes. What we do is make our rulings, and the Department of Revenue will then oftentimes address it. This happened just a couple of years ago. We issued a ruling in a case called Jedediah. It was a sales tax case, and it was a situation in which Jedediah was denied a refund because they could not return the money to their customers, a sales tax refund. They had overcollected. And the department said, you don't get the refund, because you don't know who the money then goes to once we pay you the sales tax back, because they don't know who all their customers were. And the department's position simply was, you don't get a refund, vendor, unless you can return the money to the rightful sales taxpayer.
Is that the baker in Jackson?
This is a little kiosk in the airport in Jackson.
I've
never seen it, but it's
he's a legislator.
Yeah. And so what happened is applying the law, we found that the statutes didn't back up the department's position as logical as it was. And so we ruled that the law was the way it was, and they had to return the money to the Jedediah business, even though they couldn't be sure to get that money back to their customers. The department turned right around, did not appeal, went to the legislature and said, here's the status of the law. We would like a change. And that happened in that very next session. So to answer your question, we certainly will provide whatever information you would like, but we do not generally go before the legislature to push for any kind of statutory change as to what the tax law is.
Mr. Chairman, follow up.
Follow up.
I guess I'm formally asking if you see patterns to let us know about them, not necessarily to request any change. It's just say, here's what we see as recurring patterns. You know, I see sales tax, food versus prepared foods. I know I've seen different appeals go. It'd be nice to know the patterns that are there and what we could do to make it where you get less cases in front of you.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Driscoll, I think we can certainly take a look at doing something like that. I think that's a good idea. Our practice has been to not do it. And the Department of Revenue, quite frankly, is fairly active on some of these matters, and they have a better feel for what problems they're seeing. So something that we certainly can do.
Representative Schwartz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So it's somewhat related. Having served on many county boards of equalizations over the years and talked to other counties, part of the problem at the county level is they really only get two choices. When there's an appeal to the county board of equalization, they can either deny the appeal or they can send it back to the assessor for further conversation, which often isn't that productive because they've already had a conversation, in which case the only option then is to appeal to the State Board of Equalization, which is not necessarily efficient. I think that's a word we're supposed to use, or productive. So I'm wondering if you all have had conversations, do you feel you're getting unnecessary appeals because of that limitation, or other related to improve that process?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Schwartz, I don't think that, I mean, it's true that sometimes the county boards are limited and they have limitations on what they can do, but we have seen some fairly creative rulings. Here's the other thing. We aren't permitted to set value either. The statute specifically says the Board of Equalization looks at these appeals and determines whether the county board's ruling was, you know, in accordance with the law, based on substantial evidence, arbitrary, capricious, and so forth. I'm not sure how to answer that question, whether that would be more efficient. Typically, the kinds of proceedings that really go further than us are the ones where the taxpayers have really developed their case to a point where they're going to go up anyway. Most of the cases that don't go beyond the Board of Equalization from the local landowners, they typically accept what happens at the board. And so I don't know. The problem with trying to give the county boards more leeway is then you've got them basically becoming and performing the assessor's functions, oftentimes without really any appraisal background. Neither Dave, Mr. Delacath, or I are appraisers. We're attorneys. And so that's one of the reasons there's some budget implications there. But I would say it would be difficult to and cause, I suppose, some issues if you gave the county boards more jurisdiction to kind of revalue. And that's always been the case, that you can't do that. I hope I answered your question. I'm afraid it's the inefficiency is kind of built in on that count.
That was the answer I anticipated. It's been a problem from the county's various counties' perspectives for years, and nobody's come up with an alternative, but I was thinking you might have one.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Schwartz, I'm afraid I don't.
Anything else? Let's look at your budget.
Okay. Well, with that background, you know, why don't we first turn to page 3? I'll tell you, it's a fairly straightforward budget. This is just a nice summary. And right off the bat, we only have one unit to the Board of Equalization. It's all grouped under one number. And 93-something% is salary and related costs. So, you know, less than 7% goes to everything else. You'll see the 1.7 31259, that's the budget, that's the series 100 part of it. The rest of it are things like mail, and we do some training. We have Westlaw, which is a fairly sizable expense, and that's pretty much the balance of it. So unless you want me to pull that apart and dig down a little deeper on that, why don't I take you to the exception request? We just have the one. If you turn to page 7, there is a $7,478 exception request. This was built into our budget through ETS. This is simply for computer cycling and replacement. We are told that we need to replace our computers on a cycle. And that's what the $7,478 is earmarked for. And that's only part of them. We've already replaced some of the computers for our staff, but this is for the board members.
Representative Summers.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. So when I go and I look at your base budget for 1920, it was $24,880, and then it's zeroed out to then make for this exception request of $7,478. You know, that's roughly a 3 times the previous amount, which I assume is the difference between replacing computers for whoever you replaced before and now, but that's a significant increase in that IT piece, I would assume, so I would like a little explanation on that.
Okay, I'm trying to follow you.
So if you go to page 14.
Chairman.
Oh, 14.
And you look at code number, Mr. Chairman, if you look at code number 207, or not 207, excuse me, 242, which is where your exception request is going into, you'll see that your base budget was $2480 before it gets zeroed out because you have to do an exception request for the IT, but there's a substantial difference between 7478 and 2480. So
before you answer, Kevin.
Mr. Chairman, I was just going to point out that is a zero-based item, so we take it to zero. They're on a cycle. You heard the testimony that they're replacing their board members this biennium. They anticipate, or is the last biennium, now their staff. So they're doing it in a rotational basis. So the math is simply those computers that reach that cycle or that life cycle, you know, 4 years, replacing the fifth year. That's what's driving that.
So, Mr. Chairman, this is a really small agency with 3 board members. So it just seems like that's maybe not. It just seems like it's a fairly significant bump. But I've had this problem in every agency with IT, so I'm not picking on you.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Summers, the $2480 was actually earmarked for printers that we had to replace, and that was in the last biennium. The $7,478 is, as Mr. Hibbert explained, is again cycled, and we were instructed that this is what we needed to do, and we cleared those expenditures through ETS and just passed them through site. But I certainly understand and your consternation.
As Representative Summers mentioned, you've got 3 board members, but you're asking for 6 board computers.
Mr. Chairman, we each have two screens, and we also have 3 staff members. And so there are some others that are built into that.
And so we're talking $7,400 for 6 computers, which is about, what, $1,200 or so per computer?
Yes.
Is there anything special about these particular computers?
You know, I'm not sure, Mr.
Chairman.
Does
it include all the software and programming for it?
I believe so, yes.
Kevin, do you know that?
Mr. Chairman, the differential in price that you see would be a desktop computer. I think that's somewhere in the neighborhood of $775, and then versus that on a laptop. So I'm assuming that these would be laptop computers with a monitor.
Except you say that you have two screens up.
And to add to that, Mr. Chairman, we are also upgrading to a laptop because we oftentimes take, you know, we don't now, but we would like to take those into hearings to have something before us and actually work at the point of attack. So that's right. Something we haven't been able to do and something we're trying to be able to do going forward.
All right.
And so really, unless you want to talk about anything else, that's the only exception request.
Well, you were also up for a Section 320 reduction, and the governor wanted to deny that. That's something that Section 320 is something that we did across the board with all agencies. Can you figure out why the governor denied it?
Absolutely. And actually, he's denied our reduction suggestion. So, yes, if you turn to page 7 and you also keep your fingers on page 12, 12 is really the narrative that indicates what each of the three reductions would be. If you'll see the numbers in parens, which are the reductions, there's three accounts. We have the dues license registration account, and these are all 200 series. That includes our Westlaw expense, which is fairly sizable. It also includes all of the registrations for trainings. We have a statistician who's basically had to learn how to become an appraiser and has had to take a lot of appraisal courses and become certified to understand what the assessors are doing. Plus, every board member goes through a week training at the Judicial Writing College in Reno. And Mr. Delacath would be going. And so the registration for that was included within that expense. So that is the $6,000 we would take out of that is part of this. And just to break it down, if you, per your Section 320 directive, we were going to need to find just under $14,000 to cut from our budget. And we chose to do so through our operational budget. And so that's the first chunk to get to the $14,000.
All right, so let me stop you there. So it was for education, Mr. Delacap over in Reno, and to turn your statistician into an assessor or whatever you turned him into. But that's already done now. So why do you need this money for the next biennium?
Well, it's been ongoing. I mean, the training is ongoing, and the we've had three new board members in the last year and a half. So myself, I came over 2.5 years ago. We lost Robin Cooley to the PSC. She came over with me. Dave Groover came over, and now Dave Delacat. And so we've had quite a bit of turnover, and it's not just that. There are some other trainings that we've been basically not doing because none of us are appraisers. And so we deal with a lot of fairly involved appraisal concepts and have to try to basically mesh the law and the appraisal concepts together, and so we muddle through it. But the training has always been of a benefit, and we have not been able to do that lately. That's where that would be come from. And then the Westlaw is about half of that. And the Westlaw, for each account, and we did renegotiate that with Westlaw with the help of the Wyoming Supreme Court to try to customize our subscription to that service. But that's a big part of what comes out of that account.
Okay.
The next $4,000 is in-state travel, and here's something that we've already backed off on. We use that in-state travel to try to consult with assessors throughout the state as well as to attend committee hearings. Last year, we went to a number of committee hearings. We had three bills that we were working with the committee on, but now we've basically said we cannot go anywhere and travel. The money that we have in that is really just for our statistician because he does go and he does need to be able to go to a county assessor's office or their meetings to work with them. And he went to two or three last year. So The in-state travel, 4,000 would come out of that. Right now there's 7,140, so that would cut that one in more than half. And so, in effect, we would not ever go to travel and see the county assessors. They would have to come and see us. And that's something that we regretfully decided that we would have to do. So that's the 4,000 on top of the 6,000. The last 4,000 is, office supply. That's a 4,000 cut would cut that by 25%. And this is basically our core administrative, expenses. Mail, ink for the printer, phone costs, everything basically that's incurred to administer day to day. And the problem with that is, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, is depending on how much usage we have, we anticipate that with that kind of cut, we would run out toward the end of the biennium, again, depending on how much paper and how much, phone time. We are charged a fee for any kind of long-distance calls, and we do quite a few of our hearings over the phone. And so we tried to figure out ways to avoid that, but that's built into our costs. So that's the 14,000, and it would be about 17% of our operating budget. You'll see that as part of the narrative on page 12. 17.2% decrease in our operating budget. When we went to the governor with this explanation, he decided to recommend that our budget not be reduced. Because, and that explanation is given on page 13, because that would affect our ability to complete our core function.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Marty, how many appeals do you receive a year?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Nicholas, it can be deceiving. I'm going to be completely honest. It's somewhere between 70, 80, and 100. Quite a few of those go away by themselves because they're taken kind or OGCC appeals. Mm-hmm. Some of the appeals are – so this year we've had 74 to date, and that's pretty typical. We'll have between 65 and 85 appeals. I would say about a third will actually go – or more – will actually go to some kind of a hearing or require some kind of adjudication. About half – maybe a little more will dispose of by themselves. Taxpayers will just drop their appeal for whatever reason. Or on the TIKs, which are very, very common, the big companies not agreeing with each other on the volumes produced, and they get assessed by the department based on that discrepancy. They will resolve that and then dismiss their appeals.
So, Mr. Co-Chair, it seems to me that it would be reasonable to require some type of a filing fee or a docketing fee of some sort, and then the question is how much, and then in certain types of appeals are a lot more complicated than others, and so if you could, get back to us on, to me, $50 or something like that is reasonable for a taxpayer, but if you're going through something that is complicated and it's going to turn into a 3-week hearing, kind of an issue, then that might be a different type of a fee, but we would have to understand it to make a reasonable determination on it. But, it's one of those things that we continue to provide services essentially for nothing. And it makes sense that at least mail and phones and stuff like that for everyone that calls you and deals with you as a hearing body, there ought to be a cost to it. So if you could, we'd like to get something back, by the end of markup. Because we could do a quick statutory change, we could do something to incorporate something. I mean, if it was $50, that would be roughly $4,000 a year, and we could then use that for your part of your operation expenses. And so it's just reasonable, or allow you to use it for your operating, whatever it is. But it just occurs to me that would be reasonable.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chair, we've never broached that, and I'll tell you, it was a point of interest when we brought the fuel tax adjudications in, one of the questions the Department of Transportation wanted to know is, because they were going to OAH, they had nowhere else to go, so of course OAH requires a fee. And one of the points in favor of moving those to the Board of Equalization was that the board doesn't impose a fee. I will also say that there are a number of these appeals which are $1,000, you know, $2,200. I mean, they're very small. You can have very small businesses. Sometimes the appeals are so, for instance, we also handle a license revocation appeals. So if you own or run a business, let's say you do vacuum repair out of your garage, and oftentimes these folks start a business and then they just kind of fall off and they don't go to the department and terminate their license, and the department starts assessing them BIA style and saying, you know, you've stopped filing, so we have to assess, and eventually then seeks to terminate their license. Those licenses are then revoked, and then they can appeal that to the Board of Equalization. So there's a situation where there isn't really necessarily even money involved. It's simply a matter of a revocation of a license. So, I guess it's hard to say that – I mean, I'm just not sure. You would probably have to be careful as to how you applied that fee so that you didn't dissuade, you know, the folks from using this court when all they have is a small amount of money, or really maybe no money at issue, more a right or privilege under a license. So.
Yeah, but $50 because you failed to file is no different than what your fee is for Secretary of State's office or anything like that, or a penalty or some provision. So if you could break down what you guys do for the types of hearings, and the process and typical length of time and stuff involved, and then we can say, okay. Yeah, at least we have some place to start.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Kochar, we will certainly get that for you.
Might get rid of you if you're a little smaller.
Representative Summers.
Mr. Chairman, this is just me being dumb, but I got a question for Mr. Hibbard. And this is just a slight raise, but if I look at their on 14 of their 100 series, it goes from $1,134,000 in the base budget to $1,150,000 in the standard, and then a likewise increase in benefits. And I've noticed that kind of in multiple agencies where there's been creep in that 100 series from the base budget to the standard budget. And so, one, some explanation of what that means, and then I'm wondering if you can provide me a summary by agency of each 100 series, you know, particularly the salaries piece. Is that creeping in by agency, and why is it creeping up by agency?
Mr. Chairman, there's actually a summary that exists for you already in the Chapter 17, and I would point I'll get you a copy of it. It's easy enough. I'd just point your attention to the Department Adjustments column, because that's where this all takes place. It's important to the extent that Section 319 that's in the current appropriations bill that the agencies cannot cross bieniums at or above the previous biennium in general funds. So that total amount for the enterprise, we actually came in $3,800,000 and change below the prior biennium. But that's all detailed for you, and even the revenue source in the Chapter 17 summary report, and I'll be happy to get that, a copy of that for you. There was normally what's taking place here is that on the medical benefits, the prior biennium, we had too much money that we put in there, and we discussed that, and we had a rate holiday, and then the 17 portion of that we swept. The 18 portion was still large. We didn't sweep that because we didn't know what the consequences were going to be for the unseen medical costs if we had any extreme events. But what we did do was that extra, we just simply allotted that across the board to build the 19 and 20 budget. And that equalized basically at 12%. The governor's recommendation was 11.1%, so we had 0.9% differential in what we built in the budget in April and what finally was approved. So you'll see that. And then the largest driving force, if you see a change in the medical benefit that's significant, And we talked about that for Representative Wilson had pointed that out in one place. That's driven by cafeteria plan selection, meaning that you might have had an employee, this employee might have been working with you for 10 years, and they got married. So rather than having the single selection, now they have the married selection. Or maybe they had children, so they move into the family cafeteria plan selection. And the budget division makes those adjustments. We pull it out. We take it from the PAYL system, which is a payroll system. We send that out to all the agencies. The agencies review those cafeteria plan selections that they're correct, and then we make those modifications. In the case of the labor on this report for the Board of Equalization, there's a small adjustment in there to correct an error that took place in the prior biennium. I can't remember the exact amount of money, but that's what was driving that, and it's in the Chapter 17. If I had a couple minutes, I could probably pull that up and show it to you, but that's what drove that small amount.
Okay. Any other questions? Anything else for you to tell us?
Mr. Chairman. I think really it's the same budget we've had. There have been no pay increases or anything of that nature. It's carried forward, and then we have the one exception request, and that's where we're at today.
So if we cut some of your office supplies, we've got lots of leftover paper from here and pens that you can do more and more.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's actually brings up a funny comment. You know, we're in the Hurstler, and we are planning on moving to the Hathaway first floor south permanently. But I'll tell you, as people were coming and going and evacuating from both sides, we have been scavenging office supplies as if it was not claimed or it was somebody took their eyes off of it, it might end up in our – because, I mean, we've really been trying to get ahead of the curve on the budget issues, and the office supplies are a substantial portion of what we do, especially the mail. Because we do a lot of notices, and, you know, the due process requires a lot. And so that's a big part of it.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Let's take a 10-minute break, come back at 9:45.